An unusual discovery in a horse pasture led one South Dakotan down the road of history searching for answers. From SDPB, today is Friday, May 30th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we follow the journey of humanities scholar Russ Swanson. The ag teacher from Yankton wanted to know more about the people who lived on the land before he did and how they traveled from place to place. His Google search turned into a passion, or maybe an obsession. We'll talk about Jesse James, a hanging tree, and a military road from Sioux Falls to Sioux City. We'll also check in with the South Dakota Humanities Council as they fight for access to funding, the Aberdeen Area Arts Council as they get ready for summer programming, and an artist in Vermilion whose outdoor exhibition is a staple of the city art scene. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. News is first. In the Moment on SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. The Aberdeen Area Arts Council has a full schedule of summer events ahead, from music and festivals to murals and tiny little art galleries. Grace Chipman is Executive Director of the Aberdeen Area Arts Council. She joined us on Zoom to preview the summer season.
I feel like we're at that that moment in the calendar where you close down the what are we doing for outreach in schools, or you know, bus tours, different museums will have that. And you're pivoting to that summer programming, that library programming, that, you know, summer daycare, but then also arts in the park and outdoor arts festivals. Tell me about your outdoor arts festival.
Yes, Arts in the Park is our biggest event of the year. And this year it's June 14th and 15th. We have a few more vendors this year than we have the past couple of years. So we're happy to say that it is actually growing, which is fantastic. We have some new vendors and we have many returning vendors, which we're happy to have them back. And this is the first year that I'll be running it, which is fantastic. I'm really excited about that. We're doing a few things a little differently. Every year we have like a little bit of a musical element to it as well, but instead of just having like a stage performer, we're gonna try to have a little bit more of an interactive music booth. So that maybe like kids or other folks can kind of get involved in the music as well. We have stilt walkers, we have face paints, we'll have a wandering magician. So to give people more to do, more that they can interact with, and to make it a full arts festival, a full arts experience.
Not just, shopping and bringing home the next thing, but actually getting out in the community, saying hello to people, and then doing something. How do you encourage people? How do you invite people into that space and make it fun and creative? What are some of the ways that you're planning on trying some of those things out?
So the biggest challenge is to get people out, right?
Yeah.
I think once they get there, like they're there and they see everything that's happening, and that's fantastic. But, you know, I think anyone can agree, like the biggest challenge is to get people to come out of their homes and into the event. And honestly, like social media is the way to do it anymore these days. I think that over the past year, we've been trying to really like amp up what we do with social media and how much we use our social media to entice people to come to events. We are one of the co-hosts for Winterfest, which is another arts festival that takes place late fall, early winter, just before the Christmas season. And so we kind of like amped up what we did for social media for that. And we had a far better turnout for that than we had in previous years. So we kind of just kind of use the same sort of tactics we did for that, which is, you know, showcasing more of the arts and crafts, more of the artists who are coming, make sure we're like sharing, you know, these are the artists that are coming, these are the products they're bringing, this is the work that they can do, you know, and talking about like, these are the musicians that are coming. This is our little music nook that you can come and be a part of. We'll also have like, you know, an art space set up where like people can come and create their own, you know, mini art projects.
Tell me about how people support your organization, the fundraising and sponsorships you do, and are you struggling with funding, you know, in 2025?
Yeah. So far, we're not struggling yet, but we're being mindful and we're being frugal. I feel like every year there is a slow, like a small decline in what we're able to bring in, like our membership drives. We do a membership drive every fall, or it starts kind of like late summer every fall. And typically that just consists of sending out like membership mailing, kind of asking the same sort of crop of people that we've asked, for historically, to be a part of the organization and to help with the funding of the organization. And usually like the kickback is they get like discounted program tickets, discounted, access to programming. This year went relatively well. We were about on par for normal. So far from the community, we've gotten about the same amount of funding that we typically get, which has been phenomenal. So far, we haven't had any cuts to any grants that we've gotten. We're still on the same cycle of grants, so we're doing well there so far. But again, we're being frugal and being mindful because obviously the situation being what it is, anything
Right, yeah.
can disappear at any moment.
Dan, do you have the little gallery in your office? Is that I saw
We
that on your
do.
website, so tell people about.
Yes.
Yes, because I
Yes.
love this
And
idea. Yeah.
that was the director who just left. That was his idea. When he first started, actually, he came up with that. He got the idea from like little free libraries he wanted to do. And so this is something that I still want to do. That is kind of a legacy thing that I'd like to bring into fruition because he didn't quite get it as far as he wanted to go. He wanted to put around the community little free art galleries. So like have like the little like boxes in like random parks around the community with tiny art inside of it, or like little like art supplies that people could like grab and use. So yes, we do in our window have little pieces of art. And so we usually when we're set up at events, we'll have like a mini a smaller version of that along with like supplies so people can make art and we bring it back to the office. So we actually own a lot. We have a lot of art set up from that as well too.
I love that. Little free art gallery.
Yes,
Leave a piece of art, take a piece of art. It's all tiny. Yes, I love that.
another project that we are a part of, I think this is maybe the fourth year it's been going, but it's the Downtown Art Project, and we do it with the Aberdeen Community Foundation and the Knight Foundation in Aberdeen, and it's the Downtown Art Project. So currently there are 10 pieces of art in downtown business windows. For right now through June 8th, people can vote for whichever piece of art is their favorite. And then, so the top three that were already voted on by art professionals in the community, along with number four, which is the People's Choice Award, which is what people can vote for right now, will announce the winners at the first Downtown Summer Concert, which is June 26th. The art stays up in the windows up until we try to keep it there until the fall. And then in the winter, we do the call for art again. And the next spring, new art is put up. So this has been going for a few years now. So
Yeah.
really excited to be a part of that project every year.
That's Grace Chipman, Executive Director of the Aberdeen Area Arts Council. We turn now and check in with the South Dakota Humanities Council. Christina Wee is Executive Director. She stopped by SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I feel like, and I've been saying this for a while, during COVID, every day we would go on the radio and we would say, what do we know about this that we didn't know yesterday? And every day there would be something new. And I feel like we're in that time again with some of the federal funding questions we have, where we could probably talk to you every day, and every day you would say, here's the thing that we know that we didn't know yesterday, and here's a new thing that we no longer feel certainty or stability around, a new question mark. Is that true?
Absolutely, a 1,000,000% true. This happened April 2nd when the South Dakota Humanities Council lost our funding. It feels like that happened 10 years ago.
Yeah.
It's I've told my board this and I've told my staff it literally has changed by the hour. We were at a finance meeting with our board of directors sitting down looking at our budget to the end of December trying to figure out what we can do because of these cuts. As I was sitting there, I got an email ding, and it was we found out we got a $200,000 donation from the Mellon Foundation.
Right.
Literally, as we're sitting down to plan out how do we even find our next dollar, that come I'm like, oh my gosh, it is ever changing.
Yes. And the Mellon Foundation stepped up during COVID as well to help stabilize humanities councils across the country. They have done that again. How far does $200,000 go as far as stabilizing the work that you're doing in the Humanities Council this year? How do you leverage that?
Absolutely. It's while it is a very generous gift, it's $200,000 unbudgeted. We did not anticipate it. And we are forever grateful to the Mellon Foundation for stepping up during this scary kind of unprecedented time, right? But it's not everything that we lost. We lost $950,000. And the $200,000, yes, will make a difference. It'll help us go a little farther than we had planned. But it's, you know, it's not the guaranteed funding we get every year from the federal government. So,
yeah. All right. So what happens, what has happened next in South Dakota regarding public support, people calling you saying that the Humanities Council programming is really important, essential? Tell me a little bit about public response to the budget cuts.
You know, that has been one thing that's kind of gotten me through this these hard times, is that we have had so many supporters step up and just say, I might not have a lot, but this little gift I'm giving you is making a big difference. For example, we had a donor send in a $100 check and a bunch of peace doves. And just saying, and she had this poem in there about how hard it is to be kind during these hard times, but it's important, you know, and it was so amazing. Shout out to Melinda. And we, each staff member got a stack of these peace doves, and we hung them around our office.
Like paper?
Origami.
Oh.
She made them all.
Oh.
And so it's like things like that that are just so touching, that have made just such a difference in how, in our morale. And it's really helped us keep going. And we have had some big donors actually step up in South Dakota and say, you know, I want to help, especially our donors and supporters of the Festival of the Books. And they don't want that to go anywhere. And so they are stepping up. We've had so many volunteers, so many donors step up. And so it's meant a lot to us.
Yeah. So let's talk about what's happening at the federal government. Lawsuits, lobbying, all of the above and more. Tell me about the activities that you're engaging in to get that funding back.
Yeah, so the big news that came out, was it last week or the week before? I'm like losing track, I'm telling you. I can't believe it's only been this short amount of time. So as we explained before, we worked with the Federation, which supports all 56 councils in every state and territory. So the Federation has taken up a lawsuit on behalf of all the councils, suing the National Endowment and DOGE for the funding that we were promised for FY25. And so that's every single council throughout the United States has signed on to essentially sue the federal government. And so it's a big step. It's a big historic step. You know, we're just really hoping that this will just restore our funding and help us share the humanities in South Dakota.
Are you hearing that there is the political will to go through with the defunding? I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, like, you know, for people who say, yeah, this needs to happen, these councils need to be defunded, how determined are they to have people agree with that way of thinking?
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting. We have not really heard a lot of any of our elected officials come out and say, we don't want the humanities, except for the president. You know, he came out with a skinny budget and right in there saying that we're terminating, they're proposing the termination of the National Endowment for Humanities. So, but our elected officials, and this is where it becomes difficult, none of them, especially from South Dakota, have said that they want to 100% cut our funding. And so with that, going back to the advocacy efforts, we do have a very strong advocacy campaign going on at the national and state level. You know, I mentioned before that we are working with our elected officials in South Dakota. They continue to work with us seeking more information. We would like to see more action taken. You know, I feel comfortable saying that we have explicitly asked and advocated for them to support the South Dakota Humanities Council. And we, you know, we can't get a yes or a no. We'll see what we can do. But we do definitely appreciate the work that they have put in to try to save the humanities.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about how you are planning for the Festival of Books in the fall, because some of the programming that you have already promised is ongoing.
Yep. It is very, very hard to navigate the Festival of Books this year because, you know, we had our budget for the festival passed last year. Mm-hmm. And so we are significantly behind schedule, and I know that's stressing our office out. I know, Jennifer, I love you. It's stressing Jennifer out.
Jennifer Woodman, hi.
Yes. Yep. and because we don't have any idea as to what's going to happen. Are we going to get our FY25 money back? Are our donors going to step up and help keep this in our community. You know, unfortunately, we've already had to scale back a few events. The schedule's not public yet, so I can't state which. But, you know, just looking at the straight cost of it, we've had to scale back some things. However, we are investing a lot of time and energy into making the festival the biggest one we have. When I say that, I mean that honestly. If I could show you my DMs on Instagram on how many authors I've actually been DMing, you know, I'm a fundraiser. The worst they can say to me is no, right? And we're looking at some of those big names to come out to the festival because it is a completely free event. Yeah. And, you know, we have been reaching out to some of the big names, even if it's just for a signed book. I've heard from Stephen King's team, from Brandon Sanderson's team. And they are interested in just sending some donated materials for us. Yeah. And so it's going to be a big event this year.
Yeah, people are going to want to gather and talk about this. What do you want listeners to understand about what happens next in the humanities in South Dakota?
Yeah, one of the things I want to say is that we need your support now more than ever, whether that's through volunteering for the book festival, whether that's through donations, or also volunteering to help us provide books to children throughout South Dakota. Our Young Readers book is planned. The plan is to disperse it end of August, early September. That's every third grader in South Dakota gets a free book. And that takes physical labor. Before, we were going to, you know, ship those books out, but that's a cost now we've had to cut. So we need folks to literally go to Kyle, to Lemon, to Wilmot, South Dakota, and deliver these books for us. And so there's a lot of help that we need right now. So just reach out to us on our website, sdhumanities.org.
That's South Dakota Humanities Council Executive Director Christina Wee. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Next week, a presentation takes attendees on a road to the past. Russ Swanson is a scholar and historian interested in South Dakota of the late 1800s. His presentation on Fort Dakota's military and stage roads is next Tuesday at Ronning Branch Library in Sioux Falls. That's at 6:30 p.m. local time. After that, he's going to be up in the Fort Sisseton area the week following. Now, ahead of these events, he came by the studios in Sioux Falls to talk about how he got interested in history and how he mapped the roads that once were. Now, we're going to go back to a really interesting origin story, an inciting incident of how you became, because you're not a historian.
No.
I mean, you are now.
Yeah, became
But you
one,
were
yes.
not by, yep. by training or education.
Right.
So what do you do in Southeast South Dakota?
Well, I grew up in on the family farm. I was homesteaded by my great-great-grandfather in 1870, just north of Canton along the Big Sioux River. And graduated from Canton High School, going to SDSU with a degree, graduated with a degree in ag education, animal science. And so I've taught ag in South Dakota. This will be year 27.
Wow.
Teaching ag. So, yeah, great job. Love it. And how I kind of got onto the history thing. Growing up, I always heard family stories from, like, you know, my great-great-grandfather, my great-grandfather, and my great-uncles, and just all these cool stories as a kid that I remember hearing. Oh, it must have been 8 years ago or so. I was out doing some fencing in one of my horse pastures, and I came across the remnants of an old homesteader site. And remember,
you didn't know it was there.
Well, I knew there was a settler out there at some point, but didn't really know where it was at, because my grandpa, when growing up, my grandpa told me the farm that my grandpa had, he got that in the 1930s. He always told me that there was a guy here before us and on this portion. So I ended up I found these impressions in the ground, and I wanted to find out, well, I know who this guy was. You know, here I am out fencing using modern technology, and who was the poor guy that had to put out, you know, not having the good stuff. So I became curious about that, and so I researched his name. His name was Peter Wall. I went through the government land office records and found his name, and then I was like, I wonder who he was, who this guy was, where did he come from? So just did what most people would do and Googled his name, and I typed in Peter Wall, Dakota Territory, Canton, and it took me to the Library of Congress's website, and they have a cool site on there called Chronicling America.
Oh.
Okay. Where you can look up old newspapers. And the first thing that brought up was a story about Peter Wall and how on the morning of September 19th of 1876, he was working a few miles away along the Sioux River and had his horse stolen by gunpoint by Frank and Jesse James as they were escaping from Northfield. And so I became totally fascinated with learning more about this.
Wait a minute. Outlaws took his horse?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
So that's kind of how my whole history search began. And as I began researching the story, I wanted to know, where did these guys come before that? Where did they stop? What was true? Because there's so many stories about about the James brothers and everything else. So I wanted to find out what was true. So I did kind of a 8-year deep dive in trying to find source documentation of what actually happened. So as I was doing that, last year Canton hosted a Civil War, their Civil War days, and it's awesome, awesome thing that they have down there. And one of the founders, Dave Renly, asked me if I would do a presentation on the old military trails that came up from Sioux City, since I was into looking at old maps and all that. So that's how I got started on this project, was literally just trying to find the old trail, because I always wondered, you know, the story of my great-great-grandfather, when they came here in August of 1870, first thing they did is tip the wagon over, threw a canvas over it, and that's where they stayed for a few weeks until they could build some sort of a dugout.
Where did they come from?
Sweden.
Okay.
Yep. And so while they're getting ready for winter, they're digging this dugout, and that winter he walked to Sioux City and cut lumber for the railroad, while his wife and three young kids were back here in this dugout along the banks of the Big Sioux River. And so I always wondered, you know, what route did he get to Sioux City? You know, there was no real roads back then, and just trails, and so I always kind of wondered, how did he make it down there and back, and how did anybody, you know, for that matter? So started kind of getting really interested in finding, you know, how did the people get here? What road did they take? What were the conditions like? And so that's how I kind of got interested. So I got kind of two stories going on here. I got the whole Jesse James story, and I also have the old military road story going as well.
Yeah. What was so compelling about them that, you know, 8 years plus, you just kept finding the next breadcrumb? Because lots of people have a nice or fascinating story that may or may not be true. But you're really going deep into
And that was
maps
kind of...
and Library of Congress research. And
yeah, that was probably the... You know,
what's wrong with you?
Well, that's a great question. We'll have to we don't have enough time to explore that one. But no, I guess what I wanted to find out was the truth. I wanted to find out what really happened. And because like you said, there's tons of stories out there. I mean, I've heard stories about during a blizzard, they stopped at these people's place and stayed overnight. And I've heard stories about they stopped here and carved their initials in this rock and whatever. Yeah. And well, first of all, it was in September. There's not a lot of blizzards that are going on in September. So, you know, a lot of these stories really got created around the 1924 era. Mm-hmm. 24 to 1930 is where a lot of these stories generated, because that was the 50th anniversary of the 1924 would have been the 50th anniversary of the Northfield raid. So there was a lot of renewed interest in it, and so that's where you find out the origins of a lot of these stories, and
are from this time frame when the James brothers are just really part of the popular culture.
Mm-hmm.
Is that
that was kind of
everybody's writing about them, talking about them, afraid of them.
Yep,
they're outlaws. Yeah, the Northfield raid? Explain that.
Oh yeah, well, so Northfield raid,
Minnesota.
Northfield, Minnesota. Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. So that's just it. I get so deep into this, I assume everybody knows what I'm talking about.
That's a whole signposted for you, so the people who aren't sure will be caught up. Yep.
So what happened is September 7th, 1876, the James Younger Gang came up from Missouri, and they were going to rob, they wanted to rob a bank in Minnesota. They had just, I believe it was on July 7th of 1876, 2 months prior to this, they had robbed a train near Otterville, Missouri, and one of their gang members got caught, a guy by the name of Hobbs Carey, and they all split up. They would have got away with it, but this guy started throwing his money around and raising a lot of suspicion, so he ended up getting caught, and then as to reduce his sentence, he ratted everybody out. He gave them names and descriptions, and so the heat was on. The James Younger gang needed to get out of Missouri, and according to Cole Younger, who actually wrote a book, he claimed that they were going to try to do one last robbery, get some money, and get out of the country, either go to Cuba or Australia or South America. So in deciding where to go, they knew they had to get out of Missouri, so they took a train up to St. Paul. And it was really interesting as I was researching that, because I found the train schedule from September of 1876. So I can't tell you exactly what day they were, but I can tell you exactly when they left Sioux City and where they stopped, yeah, at the different stops along the way. So so they get up to St. Paul and spend a few weeks there. They had lots of money from the Otterville robbery. So they were kind of scoping things out, but they were acting like high rollers. They had very, very nice clothes. They had went and bought the best horses and everything. So that was a lot of my research, was really finding out what was the pretext to this robbery, right, and why did it happen, and where did it happen. So after they scoped everything out, they were going to rob a bank in Mankato, but Jesse actually got recognized by one of the citizens on the street, somebody from Missouri. So that kind of spooked them, and then they decided to rob the bank in Northfield.
All right.
A couple of different reasons. Number one, Northfield only had one bank, so all the town's money was in one spot. And they also heard about some of the owners of the bank that had some money in there. One was a guy named Adelbert Ames, and another guy was named, his father-in-law was a guy by the name of Ben Butler. And so Union Civil War generals. And basically they thought, okay, this would be a good thing. We can rob the bank and kind of stick it to the Union at the same time. And so they chose Northfield. I don't know how much detail I want to go into, because they
could. Let's get back on the trail, yeah, with the horse thief. But you write a poem in here,
yeah,
in the book. The book is called A Chase to the Death.
Yep.
A Detailed Pursuit of the James Younger Gang.
Yep.
Following the Northfield Raid. Mm-hmm. So bring us down into
yeah,
this area and a little poetry that you wanted to put in.
Okay.
As well.
Well, after the attempted robbery, I should,
yeah,
say, they got shot up really bad. They didn't expect the Northfield citizens to fight back, and mm-hmm, they did. So these guys rode away. Of the eight, two of them were killed on the streets of Northfield, and the rest of them were shot up pretty good. So they make their way across Minnesota, get past Mankato, and they decide they need to split up. So Bob Younger, his arm was shattered, and it was slowing everybody down. So they decided to split up, and Frank and Jesse struck out on their own, and they stole two horses by Garden City, Minnesota, from a Baptist minister, and rode 160 miles in 56 hours on two Percheron draft horses.
Wow.
And they ended up coming across the border. They stopped the morning of Sunday, September 17th, 1876, on a Sunday morning. They stopped by Laverne, just north of Laverne, about 12 miles, had breakfast there, and after they left, the lady's husband came home, and she told him what happened, so he went and got a posse together, got the sheriff, and they ended up chasing them across the border 3 miles east of the old town of Palisade. And then from there, according to Sheriff Rice, they lost the posse at about 6:30, which would be sundown. It was getting dark when he lost the posse at the border. So they ended up going straight across the Split Rock. They crossed over the Split Rock and followed the Split Rock down to through which is now the town of Brandon. It wasn't a town then, but, and then they stole horses from a guy named Andrew Nelson. That's kind of how they got in South Dakota, and then they just kept following the Sioux River down, and that's kind of where I picked up the trail of Peter Wall. So.
Yeah. And so this, so we got two stories that were kind of, because you have through the South Dakota Humanities Council, mm-hmm, you're one of the presenters, you're going to be at the Siouxland Libraries giving one of your talks.
Yep.
But I want to pause on the James brothers, yep, or the James Younger gang for a minute and really talk about this military trail,
mm-hmm,
that kind of, as I understand it, starts with you asking a question with like, how did people get from, were,
yeah,
they following,
yep,
where the native tribes had gone and those
yeah,
established trade routes,
mm-hmm,
were they cutting their own trails? What are some of the things that you learned about that military road?
Yeah, well, that was honestly probably one of the hardest things to research. Doing all the Jesse James stuff, I could go find old newspapers from 1876.
Right.
I could find, But finding, you know, people just didn't write down, oh, we took this road and this is what it looked like and this is where it was. So it was actually, it was a lot harder than I thought to find the military road information.
Yeah. U.S. military road.
So
from Sioux Falls to Sioux City.
Yes.
Is that what we're talking about?
Okay. Yep. Yep. Mm-hmm. And actually, if you take Southeastern Avenue, it's pretty much where it came into, you
really?
Know, there's actually a marker along there. And
I don't think I knew that.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So there we go.
I lived here a long time without knowing that.
So, yeah. So yeah, in my presentation, I'm trying to do is lay out a little bit of the history first. So people understand where did Sioux Falls come from? What was the origins of Sioux Falls? What happened in 1862 when everybody left because of the Armadon murders that happened? And so during that time, a lot of things were happening in South Dakota. You know, we had the Sioux River was pretty much the interstate at that time for trappers to come up. And they would come up to, there's a small town called Calliope, which is about the only thing between Sioux City and Fort Dakota at that time. So we're talking late 1850s. So there was this trail, and the original trail was a trail that actually followed the east side of the Sioux River. And it went basically from Sioux City, and it went all the way up. And I'm going to just kind of use some more modern terms here. But it would follow up kind of by Huset Speedway and follow up the river. And you would stay literally on that side of the river. And then you could hook down into Fort Dakota without having to cross the Sioux River.
Oh.
So in 1864, a Patty was sent up here to establish a route to get from Sioux City to Sioux Falls. And so that's kind of where that first trail started coming into play. So they would come up along the Iowa side to Calliope, which is Hayward now, and they would cross the river, and this trail was kind of cut up there that would go through Canton and then from Canton up to Sioux Falls. Well, then started finding more research about this stagecoach road that would run along from basically Fort Dakota to Sioux City. And so there was actually two trails. And that was part that was kind of confusing, was to try to separate which one was which. And sometimes they shared some of the same routes as well. But the stage trail was really interesting. There was a stage would leave from the Cataract Hotel. Everybody knows about the Yankton Trail, but not too many people know about the trail that followed the Sioux River and would go down to Sioux City. So what would happen is at times you could cross the Sioux River. So if the river was low, you could cross at Calliope and then go down that way. If the river was high, then you'd stay on the South Dakota side and you'd basically follow the river along Lincoln County and into Union County, which used to be called Coal County before the war. So it's another thing I learned. but yeah, so then they'd get to about 5 miles from Sioux City and they'd take a ferry across. So.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And then how did you figure out how to put together the maps and everything that we might see in this presentation? Overlay.
Yeah. And it's kind of funny. Sometimes when I was doing my James Brothers research, I actually had a program called Google Earth Pro, and I clicked a button on accident and it threw a picture on top of my map. And I'm like, oh, what'd I do? You know, and I'm like, hey, that's cool. I wonder if I could put a map on top of a map. And so what I've been doing is I've been taking old,
shout out to Google.
Exactly. Big time. And it's really cool. So what I did is I've taken, old township maps, and overlaid them on top of Google Earth Pro. And I'll usually go township by township. And I've got those laid over the top, and then when I find a something that's well documented, I can put a pin on there, and then I can fade my maps in and out, so then I can actually see, okay, here's what happened, and here's where that location actually is today. So I've got this map of eastern South Dakota that's got all these pins on it from, you know, old. One of the things that's been kind of cool is on the Lincoln County map, it had the old school districts. And being a school teacher, I thought it was kind of cool.
Yeah.
So I was able to put a pin on every single school that was in Lincoln County. And so I can toggle that on and off and see actually where those pins were today or where those schoolhouses used to be. So
that's fascinating.
Yeah, it's been, like I
said. So at the presentation at the library, you'll have visual
so
people can see and follow these things and ask questions about the place that there must be an endless fascination with learning about the place that you're at.
Oh, it's
the history of that place.
Yeah, it's I don't know. It's sometimes it's overwhelming because it's so cool. You find this cool pile of evidence. You really don't know which direction to go with it, you know. And so, for example, as a kid growing up, my great uncles always talked about something called the hanging tree that was just on the other side, my other side of the property from ours. And so along the Sioux River. And so I was asking, well, what's the hanging tree? And they said, well, supposedly these father and two sons from McCook County got caught stealing horses, and they hung them by the river and buried them there. So it was another bunny trail. I started going down and finding stories and trying to find information about that, because that's something you don't find a lot of information on. People didn't put that stuff in the papers, you know.
Right.
So a few years back, as I was doing the research on the James story, I found out that one of our neighbors, it was his great-grandfather that they stayed overnight at by Klondike, Iowa, on the South Dakota side. So I was talking to him about it, and he was telling me about what he knew about the stories that he had heard. Well, then I asked him, I said, well, what do you know about the hanging tree? And he said, well, you pick me up sometime, I'll show you where those guys are buried. So we went down there, and because he was shown, when he was a kid, his grandpa showed him back in the probably mid-30s. And so looking around, we found some depressions in the ground, you know, like still don't know for sure, but I ended up having a former student that did some archaeological work when he was in college out in Wyoming. And he came, and we set up a dig site, and actually found at about 54 centimeters down, found a oyster shell button from a shirt that dates to about 1860. So, just, again, so many rabbit holes and cool stories. It's like you could spend hours and hours a day just researching this stuff. So.
What's your advice to people who are interested in following some of those rabbit trails, but don't, you know, I start with a Google search and then I'm stuck. Give us like two tips before we let you go.
Yeah, I would say number one is, if you want to do free, go to Chronicling America through the Library of Congress, where you can research old newspapers. If you want to go a little deeper than that, there's a paid subscription service that I go to called newspapers.com. And that's,
we have that too.
That's awesome. Awesome for research. Another thing I would do is a good free site is, a lot of times you end up going to genealogy when you're trying to find some of this stuff. So findagrave.com, another interesting one to go on. And then a really cool one is it's just glorecords.com. It's Government Land Office Records.
Okay.
And you can find original land patent. So if you know, like when I teach ag, you know, I teach about townships. We're in the fifth principal meridian here, so we talk about township and range numbers and section numbers and all that. So if you know, like, or even if you don't know, if you know that your great-great-grandfather homesteaded here in South Dakota, you can go to the Government Land Office Records website. You can look up by county, and you can look up by name if you want to. But you got to be careful, because sometimes the names are spelled a little differently. Mm-hmm. You know, Svensson became Swanson. And so, you know, you got to make sure you're looking in the right direction on that. But it will then tell you the original, the location of the original land patent holder for all the homesteads in the state, or actually in the whole region here. And that's really cool. And then you can also click another button, and it'll show you the documentation that of the original land record. So if you're into family history and you want to look up some of that stuff, it's pretty cool to do
Understand
that. So there's about three or four sites that I use to do a lot of my research.
And you might come up with a really good story, too.
No, exactly. Yes.
Russ Swanson's presentation is sponsored by the South Dakota Humanities Council. It's in Sioux Falls on Tuesday, June 3rd at Ronning Branch Library, and again the next week at Fort Sisseton. We're going to put some links up on our website so you can find more. That's sdpb.org/news. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. It's that time of year again. 75 paper squares of art set to be wheat pasted to a wall in Vermilion. The dystopian artwork of Thunder Domesticity, Witness Me, is up now, or rather, for now. Claire Lockhart curates the works of art and pastes them to the exterior wall of the No. 7 Center Gallery. She's also known as Miss Art World South Dakota, and she is a recipient of the Pollock Krasner Foundation grant. She joined us from SDPB's studios on the University of South Dakota campus in Vermilion.
So this is our post-apocalyptic themed national exhibition that was designed to uplift and celebrate the strength of women, particularly when it feels like the world is ending. But Thunder Domesticity, it actually came from Thunderdome from the Mad Max universe, and then right. Domesticity, and it's a way to celebrate like these skills that are typically associated with, you know, like women's work, and right. it came out into a collaborative photography series that I'm working with Erin C. Packard,
yeah.
and we have so much fun creating this artwork that a few years ago we decided to open it up to a national exhibition so we could showcase other incredible artists who are also dealing with this existential dread
in the arts. So for people to understand, before we get into some of the art itself, this is, you know, the wheat pasting on the outside of the building. Help us understand how the art is displayed.
So we have a very unconventional exhibition for this unusual artwork, and it works perfectly since the theme is dystopia. We make... I shouldn't say we. Erin makes these gorgeous archival pigment prints of the artwork that is selected for the show. That way, I can literally glue it to the outside of his building at Number 7 Center here in Vermilion. And it allows us to share the artwork publicly through the full run of the exhibition, and it's outdoors. And we have so much incredible public art here in Vermilion. It fits right in.
You put out a call for submissions. How does the gathering of the artists work?
Oh, this is such a long process. So after deciding the theme for the show, and this year's exhibition was called Witness Me, and I was hoping to get a lot of figurative artwork, which I did, and it's amazing. But I put out the call for art, and we get artists from across the country who send photos to me of their work, and I have the very difficult job of narrowing down the show to what will fit in the exhibition. Mm-hmm. And I pick the best, most diverse art that I can. And once I get that artwork, then I work with Erin, who creates those prints. And then I get to do the curation and all that math to figure out how to get 75 amazing works of art to fit on that one wall.
Yeah. What were you noticing about thematically from the submissions? When the title is Witness Me, and you're leading with this idea of, you know, you might be feeling an existential dread in gender areas right now. What did you receive for submissions?
I have such an incredible variety of photographs, paintings, prints, drawings, oh, even fiber art. And a lot of it is portraiture or figurative artwork showing strong people. Some of the subjects look like they came off the set of a Mad Max movie, and it's wonderful. And some of it's more subtle, and it's just showing like strength of people within natural environments. There's such a great variety of work. I hope people will be able to stop by at the opening reception to see it for themselves.
So talk about when you make the display, are you thinking composition, color? How are you arranging it so that it also looks like an entire whole?
It's a bit of a process, but you're right about doing color and composition. I usually will sort the artwork so that way one of my goals, of course, is to make sure all the artwork looks good and it's in the best place for it to be. Yeah. And because there's 75 works of art this year, I need to make sure they're in conversation with each other
yeah.
and not competing with each other. But then I want to make sure it's balanced so I don't have too much dark work in one section and too much bright work in another. And, one thing that was unusual this year is the amount of artwork that incorporates toys. Like, there's a rubber ducky. There are Barbie photographs that are incredible. And so to space out this more whimsical artwork with the more serious artwork was also quite a challenge. But I'm really pleased with how it turned out. The submissions are so fantastic.
I wonder why toys. I see a Mr. Potato Head as well. Barbie, Mr. Potato Head.
Yeah.
What's going on there, do you think?
Oh, I don't know if it works as an analogy, a way mm-hmm. for people to relate to each other. I know some of the artists are working with more whimsical subject matter because yeah. it's just a good coping mechanism to make art that makes you feel good when it feels like the world is ending.
I'm also noticing a theme, florals, you know, how often flowers show up in different images. Tell me a little bit about what you noticed there.
Oh, the different patterns and with the florals. So it could be, we have one work where it's a silkscreen print from a protest on top of a floral pattern. But then there's also works of art where it's more a natural environment. Or there's a ton of mixed media work as well where these plants and natural surroundings are encompassing the subjects.
Yeah, and adorning. You know, whoever centered in the image, you know, being adorned with flowers, which I think has a lot. A flower juxtaposed with a gun. Mm-hmm. Just all sorts of interesting things that artists are coming together with. Also, a vocalization, a screaming, or a silencing. I think that's interesting as well. Did you pick up on that at all?
The different amount of expressiveness is, it's just exciting to see how people are sharing their feelings through this different types of visual medium.
Yeah. One of my favorites is Abby Graham's ribbons, like a state fair ribbon of fiber art, embroidery, and floss and fabric that are, you know, best in no thank you, best in nope.
I love those. I should give her an award, but she already created it herself.
She created the award herself. Anything else you've got working on that you want to tease here while we've got you in the studio?
Oh, my goodness. My brain is totally set on this Thunder Domesticity Witness Me exhibition. I haven't even had time to think about my own work.
Right. There is an impermanence to the display because of the wheat pasting on the, you know, these are not original artworks that are on the outside of the building. When you envision this and as you watch that unfold throughout the duration of an exhibition, how's that changed for you from what you maybe originally planned to how it works in real life?
I am infatuated with this ephemeral nature of wheat paste because I put it up and on the first day it looks so nice and clean and pristine. But as we know, the weather in South Dakota can be a little aggressive and it wears at the art. It pulls at the corners if we have hail and wind and snow, hopefully not snow this time of year, but we have in the past at different times of the show. But it wears at the artwork and it's really fun to see how the images change and degrade over time, particularly with this dystopian theme of the work. And I hope it encourages people to check out the exhibition while it's up for the next couple of months to see these different changes.
Claire Lockhart, always a delight to sit down with you. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate you so much.
We'll see you next time.
Bye.
The art reception for Thunder Domesticity Witness Me is tonight. It's at the No. 7 Center Gallery in Vermilion from 5 to 7 p.m. local time. And the exhibition is up now on the northern exterior wall of the No. 7 Center Gallery, faces Vermilion City Hall. And don't forget, it's a temporary exhibition of paper wheat pasted to an outdoor wall, so catch it while you can, preferably before the rains wash it away. My guest has been Claire Lockhart, Miss Art World South Dakota. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you from all of us here at SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Thanks for listening.